Yes. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and others. How are we all doing today? Yeah, I mean, for real. It's been a fun weekend. It's been an amazing weekend, and we want to thank you all for being here at 11:30 on a Monday for our panel, Kelly Sue DeConnick in Focus. Just as a reminder, unfortunately, due to a family emergency, Kelly Sue will not be able to be here as was originally planned today. She had to go home suddenly, but we do have three scholars who will be discussing her works in various academic lenses, and we will be able to take questions and discuss the themes that we find present in her work at the end of their presentations today. So today, before we get started, I want to just give you all a little bit of a reminder of where you are and what we're doing. We're the Comics and Popular Arts Academic Conference at DragonCon. We put on these kinds of conferences every year for the past 8 years. This is our 8th annual mini-conference here, and we look at all of the things that we all come to DragonCon for: comics, movies, music, TV, all of the sci-fi and fantasy stuff that we talk about. And we look at it through the academic lenses of the arts and humanities. And the kinds of things that we put together, we do with the help and the long teamwork of people like Zeno here in Comics Track, who have worked with us to give us panel space and to give us the time and the space to work with you all. You can find us online at thehangman.com/CPAC. At that link, you can also find a subdirectory that has our AV from past years. You know, various presentations, various panels, roundtable discussions, all kinds of things. And that will be, after this year, populated with yet more stuff, in case you missed anything this year. You can also find us on Twitter at DC_Academics, and you can find us on Facebook at DragonCon Academics. This is one of three presentations that we've got going for you today. After this, we have both a DC Comics and Cultural Studies panel and a Comics in the Classroom Studies panel that we're talking about, you know, trying to figure out exactly what the schedule is going to be on that. But we will have a solid announcement for you here at the very end of the day of this presentation to tell you exactly how that's going to go down. We do hope you'll stick around with us for all of our offerings today. We've enjoyed your spending time with us this whole weekend. And I once again want to thank all of you for being here. We literally could not do this without you. So thank you so, so much for being here. That all being said, let's get started today. We've got on this panel today John Flowers from UC Carbondale, and we've also got Ahmed Yunus and Chandra Jenkins, and John will be going first, and he's going to be presenting his paper, Captain Marvel and John Dewey's Theory of Imagination. So give it up for John.
Thanks. All right, so a little bit of background on this presentation. Initially, or what this is a condensed version of a 25-page paper that I wrote. Some people write fan fiction. I write philosophy. It's what I do. I really love it. So that's where this came from. I was reading Captain Marvel, and I was like, holy crap, I could write something on this. So I did. Initially, the title of this paper is Higher, Faster, Furthermore, Captain Marvel and John Dewey's Theory of the Imagination. So I'm not going to dive right into theory. The first thing I'm going to do is show you a panel from Captain Marvel issue 1. This is the panel where Carol makes the decision to go to space, right? She says, if you can't read it, I need to... There's a moment when a child runs, or a girl runs so fast that she takes flight. At that moment, the world no longer has a hold on her. I need to find that. I need to go to the edge of myself, like taking a car out into the desert and driving it as fast as it can go. I need to do that. I need to go to the edge of myself so that when I turn around, I can look back and see where I belong. And this is in both of these panels, all right? This is the concluding panel of the first one, where Captain Marvel is actually going to space, right? So this panel is pretty important for a number of reasons that I'm going to enumerate in a moment, but first I got to get you through some theory. I'm sorry. All right, so this slide pretty much gives a general rundown of John Dewey's theory of the imagination. I'm not going to read from it, but explain some of the different points here. So when Dewey is talking about a dramatic or experimental way of understanding the actual in light of the possible, he's referring to the way that things are undergone or lived through. Specifically, he's talking about the way in which experience, any experience, has a beginning, middle, and end. It's got a dramatic structure. Since all experience, if it is to be an experience, has a dramatic structure, it has a particular quality to it, right? We can talk about it in terms of this storm, this conference, this character that sets it apart from all the other characters. All right, so what Dewey means by projected completion of action is that when we act, we project the completion of that act into the future. And then we choose the ways to complete that action that are appropriate to the results of the action, or what Dewey calls the end in view. So in the first panel, when Carol is talking about, when Carol is saying that she needs to find the edge of herself, she's talking about engaging in a course of action that leads to the projected end of figuring out where she belongs. Going to the edge of herself is that course of action. But there's another reason I chose this first panel. So Carol specifically speaks to how there is an instant where a child, a girl specifically, is running so fast that the world actually loses its grasp on her. This is especially important for our conversation with Dewey because it is in children that we find the freest play of the imagination. While children cannot imagine some possibilities due to their lack of experience, adults have actually lost some of the imaginative powers that they possess as children. Thus, when Carol is seeking to recapture that childlike experience of the free play of imagination, the experience of being able to imagine in the Deweyan sense, so much more, she is seeking to recapture her ability to see her own actuality in light of all the possibilities available to her. And this is what pushes Carol into space. She needs to figure out her actuality, the place where she belongs in light of her possibility, e.g. the car. So this is not just a theme that runs through Carol's time in space. So before we get to space, I need to talk about Carol on Earth. So this is a panel that focuses on Carol consoling Helen Cobb upon the death of her partner. So due to her grief, Helen is unable to see or to view a possibility beyond the loss of her partner. Carol, on the other hand, sees the actuality of Helen's grief against the possibility of her living a full life in her remaining years. The next big thing that Carol is talking about here is Carol is projecting towards a future where Helen makes actual the possibility of being happy, the next big thing, by bringing forwards the experiences that Helen has had with her partner as the big things, right? Urging her to project forwards the possibility of going beyond the actuality of her grief. So further, Carol carries forwards this idea of making the actual possible and then moving beyond current actuality, her current situation, as she engages with her own grief. Spoiler alert, I'm sorry, I should have prefaced that I'm going to spoil the heck out of everything up to Captain Marvel and the Carol Corps. Probably should have done that at the beginning. Carol carries forwards this idea of making the actual possible and then moving beyond current actuality as she engages with her own grief over Helen's death. When she says that a soul will damn sure find a way to be the stars that we were meant to be, Carol is expressing her strong belief in the power of the imagination to project action into the future for the sake of becoming, when aligned with a purpose, the things that we were meant to be. She is unwilling to accept that death or indignity are barriers to making the actual possible. So what she's saying in this panel is, death and indignity be damned, we will become the stars we are meant to be. So she is aligning the imagination with a qualitative unity, a structure that runs through the entire course of action to achieve a particular purpose. And that purpose in this panel is to become of the stars that we were meant to be. So this is a gigantic quote. I am not going to read it verbatim, but I will direct you towards the question of meaning. So meaning is the total effect of a thing on the overall situation that the thing finds itself in. So when we talk about the possible values that emerge from a situation, we are talking about the way that the results of the action we are doing or undergoing have effects on the entire situation, which is their meaning. So the meaning of a thing is its effect on the whole situation. The meaning of me lifting my hand like this is different in different situations versus this versus this. So, now, give me a second. So this becomes moral because our actions have meaning for others because we are in a society. So for Dewey, and I apologize for all the theory that I'm throwing at you, a society consists of all the relations between ourselves and others. To be social for Dewey is to be in transaction with others, which means we affect and effect others as we are affected and effected by them. None of us are isolated from one another in a social sense, because our actions have meaning for everyone else and thus have affects and effects on everyone else. So to be a moral individual for Dewey is to be aware of the affects and effects of these actions on the total situation, our society, that we find ourselves in. This is at the core of what it is to be moral. So what does this have to do with Carol Danvers? Right? Recall in the beginning of the presentation where Carol stated that she needed to go out to the edge of herself, like taking a car out into the desert to see how fast it goes. In this panel, Carol has reached the completed end of her actions. She has realized the end in view that she set for herself when she got to space, only to present it with a brand new possibility. However, this possibility is not one that is morally or ethically acceptable to her. So essentially, the universe is dangling the keys to a Maserati in front of her, but she doesn't want that car. She's perfectly happy with, I would think, Carol's a Ford Mustang kind of girl. Right? And so this is the visual representation of that possibility, right? When presented directly with the choice of becoming more than herself, transcending her actuality through the possibility of a power that she has been offered, and this is a power that she has seen corrupt others, she rejects it because the actualization of that possibility would result in her becoming everything other than what she wished to be when she began this process of finding herself, a process that she has completed at this point. Her emphatic no, a rejection of a possibility whose purposes, whose qualitative unity is fundamentally opposed to her nature, indicates her moral decision-making where transcendence of her actuality is concerned. Essentially, Carol rejects this power because while it would allow her to complete the stated end of saving the universe, the way in which she would do it would ultimately result in an immoral situation. She would not be acting true to herself. So, given that I thought I had 15 minutes instead of 20, I kind of got to the end. Yeah, right. So, in the end, Carol Danvers is a character who more than anything believes in the power of the imagination, that is, to make actual the possible. She is defined by it and makes actual this belief through her embodiment in the world. It is this embodiment of her belief that makes Carol, in my opinion, a superhero, but ultimately one grounded in experience. As she says here, if that's what you want, I believe you can do whatever you set your mind to. This is probably one of the core ideologies that Carol's entire character is aligned around. If that's what you want, I believe you can do whatever you set your mind to. You can accomplish those ends that you set for yourself through the imagination, so long as you do so in a way that is both moral and true to your own qualitative unity, your own purpose, right? And this is the way in which Carol says, we will become the stars we were meant to be, by acting in accord with the qualitative unity of ourselves to reach the ends that we project for ourselves. Higher, Faster, Further, More, Indeed. Thank you very much.
Yes.
Thank you very much for that, John. That was fantastic. And up next, we have Ahmed Yunus and we have Chandra Jenkins, and they are going to be presenting together their paper, Comic Feminism, Reimagining Traditional Perceptions of Heroism. Are you guys going to take care and stand up, or are you going to go from here?
I'm sitting. If that's cool with everybody, I'm presenting from sitting because I have a problem. I find it problematic to stand in front of people like I'm some sort of authority because we're all comic book fans and I think that we're all kind of learners together, so I'm going to sit. So if you all can hear me and it's cool, I'm going to sit here. So I'm starting our paper because we co-wrote our paper together, and I'm going to talk a little bit about, I'll just start talking. So kind of how I approached my part of the paper was through, I am starting my theory because unapologetic about it. Bell Hooks, who's phenomenal. She's one of my favorite theorists on the planet. And she writes in Teaching to Transgress that theory is a place where she finds comfort, and it helps her make sense of the world when she realized that that theory existed, and that was really helpful for me because I've always been a nerd, and I've always tried to bring academics into nerddom and nerddom into the academy. There's lots of resistance on both sides of that, and in Pope's book, Outlaw Culture, she talks about the pedagogy embedded in pop culture, and the curriculum that's also embedded in that as well. I'm studying education and curriculum and cultural, like with a curriculum emphasis. So I study a lot on how people teach, which is what pedagogy is, and what you teach, which is what curriculum is. And so if reading these comic books have curriculum embedded within them, which is what I think, then that's a thing that I think everyone should have a conversation about, because we're all learning this information and without having that conversation. It's just like, instead of, so taking the conversation from Green Lantern's really awesome or terrible or however you divide out on Green Lantern, and before anybody questions me, I don't read Green Lantern, so I don't know anything really about it. But just as an example, because it's the first one I think of. Taking it beyond, like, which Green Lantern do you like, to a conversation of what do you learn from Green Lantern? What are we learning in that space? So here I'm talking about Kelly Sue's work, because I love Kelly Sue's work. I think it's fantastic, and I'm looking specifically, I'm going to look more at, because you're talking about Bitch Planet, I'm going to talk more about Pretty Deadly, because Pretty Deadly is one of my favorite books that she writes, and I think there's a lot embedded within it. So Pretty Deadly, there's also going to be spoilers in Pretty Deadly. It's worth reading even if you know how it ends. So Pretty Deadly is a kind, on one level, is a retelling of beauty conquering death. So that whole, I don't remember the Greek myth name on it because there's only so much space in my brain. So that one idea that beauty conquers death, and so in the story of Pretty Deadly, death decides he doesn't want to give up being death, and he wants to stop the cycle of death and life so that he can remain with beauty. Death meets beauty because beauty's husband at the time is kind of a jackass and locks her away because beauty, he's Fox, that's the character's name. Fox doesn't want beauty around anybody else. So, in this story, throughout the course of it, there's a couple things that happen that are, I think, kind of important. One of them is a presentation of what Bell Hooks calls a feminist masculinity. So it's a presentation of what masculinity could look like if it's not toxic. And also not feminine. Because it's not, Fox is this character that shows up this way. So he starts out very toxic in that he hides beauty away from everybody because he's super possessive and jealous of everybody looking at her. And nobody likes that. And so Beauty ends up meeting death because she decides that she'd rather die than live in a tower. And I don't blame her because that sounds super boring. And so that is one of the things that I think on that level that that's like the prime example of toxic masculinity. That super dominance, that super possessiveness, that hyper, like, I'm going to control your life because I can. And I'm going to control it to the extent that nobody else can interact with you and you cannot interact with anyone else. which is terrible. And so when death takes Beauty into his realm, which in this one is a cavern, Fox realizes what he's done. He realizes that through his own actions, he's caused his own loss. But instead of becoming even more hyper-possessive of it and being obsessive, when Death offers him a deal to, if you go and kill the monster that comes out of this river, then you can see Beauty again, you can have her, you can apologize, and you can, like, take on this, like, trade between dudes over this woman, which is not, like, really problematic. Fox initially says yes, because still super hyper-masculine and super toxic. But in the course of his journey going to find the monster, which ends up being a baby girl, Fox realizes that what Death is trying to do is trying to stop how the cycle proceeds. He realizes that if he kills this monster, which is the new baby girl Death, he will be complicit in keeping the reality how it is, where Death doesn't continue on. So he makes a choice, and it's the first choice that's really important. He makes a choice to, instead of killing this little baby girl, he raises her. Knowing that he's raising her in order for her to become Death and for her to learn what life is, what the high cost of living is. That's why Fox takes her on. And instead of being this possessive person anymore, he's no longer a possessive male, he embodies traditionally masculine qualities of caretaker, well, provider and protector, but he adds on the caretaker element as well as he raises this child by himself through the American Southwest Desert, and they go through this whole journey. And ultimately, at the end of the story, everybody ends up all together. Fox, Beauty, Death, Sissy, who is the new Death, and then also this whole group of everybody, all the Reapers, end up together. And what ultimately shows up is who saves the day is not Fox, it's not even the new Death, it's not the original Death, but it's Beauty, who for the entire story has her agency very limited. She's ultimately the one who takes the action and kills Death and saves the world. And it's a very quiet, kind of heroic way that she does that, and it's in a way that, where she has been bound, not physically, like she's not ever like chained, but she's been bound in like geographical spaces because she's been confined to Death's cavern. After she was confined to the tower space. And in this presentation, Kelly Sue does a really powerful way of presenting both a different kind of masculinity, which Hooks calls very important in her book, Feminism is for Everybody. She points out, and other people have pointed out, that feminists have been very, very good about pointing out ways that masculinity is toxic and terrible, and the patriarchy and the dominance and the domineering and all of those elements, how that hurts everybody, but have lacked a little on presenting an option, a new way. And in Pretty Deadly, we get not only a heroic feminist presentation, despite structures that might look like that it would not be a heroic feminist presentation of Beauty, you also get a new way of being masculine, because without any sort of, there's very little femininity within Fox. He's still very much a dude who's good at shooting, he's good at riding horses, like all of these different things, but he ultimately cares for Sissy and helps to support her in her own journey, so that when Sissy shows up in the cavern, he doesn't lead her there. He doesn't force her into the cavern. Sissy makes the conscious choice to take on the role of Death, and Beauty makes the conscious choice to save herself. And Fox is just kind of there being the guy that was along for the ride for the most part. And I think that's where I end on my thought.
I'm sorry.
No.
Go ahead and evoke my powers. In the beginning, let me say, in the name of the beginning before all beginnings and the ending after all ends, the source of beauty, love, mercy, and justice, I greet you all with peace. It's an honor, absolute honor for me to be here. My mind is blown by the last 3 days. What I'm going to do is kind of try to draw a link between Bitch Planet, Captain Marvel, and Ms. Marvel. I will end with a heavier analysis of Ms. Marvel, because I don't think that many folks in the comic world get to hear an analysis of Ms. Marvel from a Muslim American. And I'm in a unique position, I think, to do so. The reason I started the way I started is because I want to make it very clear that I'm not a postmodernist. So what the hell does that mean? That means that I don't believe that the reality that exists is limited to what I have experienced in reality, right? I believe, like Paulo Freire believed, that there's a tension between objectivity and subjectivity. That there is a reality that I don't know about, I didn't read about, I didn't experience. It exists out there. Like, for example, the oppression of people that do not have the life experience that I have. And we're treated in the first issue of Bitch Planet to this brilliant question. How can I be a part of solidarity if I'm not oppressed? I don't feel oppressed. I don't feel like there's anything wrong with the reality that I'm living. And we're presented with the proposition that one who is interested in social justice should not be limited to their subjective reality in this world. Because if you have privilege that has taken you outside of the orbit of oppression, or if you do not understand the structures of oppression as they exist and think you are not oppressed, but in fact you are oppressed, we want to say there's still a role for you. There's still a role for you in social change. Right? It's not just the subjective reality that you live that should have weight, valence, for how we see the world. We should be the people that see the lived realities of others and endow their experiences with the authority and authenticity that it deserves. Bitch Planet number 2, cultural misconceptions of feminism. And in the essay in the back, there's this quote of Katy Perry, who basically says, like, I love women, women are great, but I'm not a feminist. And much of this comes from our inability to take feminism as a concept outside of its static place. Right? So often we talk about feminism as though it is one thing. No, there are many waves of feminism. There are feminists that believe that women are different than men. They see reality different than men. There are feminists who believe that that's a bunch of bullshit. Right? The only thing that binds them together, the only thing that binds them together is the proposition that we should all be invested in the advancement of girls and women. And I point you to the Nike Foundation's project called The Girl Effect. I point you to an NGO in Afghanistan called Skatistan, which helps young girls get educated and skateboard at the same time. Like, it speaks to the proposition. It is extremely awesome. Yeah, it's extremely awesome. So, what do I want to say about issue 2? Do not allow anyone to pigeonhole you into their understanding of what feminism or a feminist is. Allow yourself to build your own perspective and to take ownership of that perspective, regardless of who's trying to push you in different places. Issue number 3, we deal with... Sorry, I am going to do just a little bit of theory. Right? Because, I mean, you're pushing me, and then she didn't go on the pen on the stage, and now I feel like I'm all different. Okay. Foucault says... was that good? Bad? I literally said the dude's name. Look, Foucault says that one of the ways you come to know yourself is not just by your own experience and your own subjectivity, but by being objectified by dividing practices. Which means what? You come to see yourself in the way that the oppressor has told you you are. You come to see, oh, the TV tells me Muslims are violent, young Muslims start believing that Islam encourages violence. The TV says Muslim women are not allowed to be equal in society. Young Muslim girls start to believe that young Muslim women are not allowed to be equal in society. Your objectification erects itself. I know that there is a double pun there. Erects itself, right? Pursuant to the objectification and the dividing practices of other people. And that relates to body image, which is, I can tell you from my own personal experience, is an issue that men deal with, not just an issue that women deal with. Number 4, white feminists can be racist. Like, just, of course they can. Of course they can. Of course they can. Of course they can. Why? Because prejudice exists among all people. Black people can be prejudiced. Of course they can. Of course they can. But to be racist assumes that there is a corollary power construction with that prejudice. You have the power to enforce that prejudice in the society within which you live. And so we have to understand that whiteness consumes blackness in America. Maleness consumes femaleness. Heterosexuality consumes homosexuality. They dominate the other identity. And so if we're going to be in the business of feminism and changing society, we should be in the business of reflexivity, of being honest with ourselves at an individual level, at a familial level, at a community level, at a con level. We should be honest with ourselves about where we are and where we want to be. Let me move very quickly to Captain Marvel, and I will only touch Captain Marvel for a couple of reasons. Oh no, did I say bad words? I'm sorry.
I think somebody's just a little
geeky. No, it's good. Once you say Foucault, everybody's out. Everybody's out. Let me just say that what Professor Flowers showed as kind of like that ultimate ego moment for Carol Danvers, it's so important. It's so absolutely important, the proposition that to become the greatest potentially untested person that you can become, right, is not to embrace a neoliberalism that says that your value comes from your purchasing power, or your value comes from your ability to create money for other people, or your value comes to fruition when you look like the other, when you act like the other. It's a very intentional choice to not allow the ego, which religious people say stands for expelling God out, to not allow the ego, right, which is a product of neoliberalism, which is a product of the economic realities that we live every single day. The proposition that the most important thing in the world is your perception of your ability to acquire what it is that you want to acquire in this world. It's an extremely powerful argument for the proposition that being the best includes the permission to be different. Not only from others, but from what others project upon you as the best version that you can possibly become. And that's very, 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 very important. Okay, let me now step into Ms. Marvel. I'm going to start with a piece of the story, and then I'm going to tell you a little bit of data, and then I'm just going to sit down. In Ms. Marvel, we see in the first picture of the first panel a young Pakistani-American Muslim woman who is eyeing a bacon, lettuce, and cheese greasy sandwich at the local corner store. And I can tell you from personal experience that that is what Muslim Americans do. Because we don't eat pork. And I find all of the time that, like, when people come back from Muslim-majority countries who are Muslims that have only lived in America, they always have the story about, like, meat lovers, extra pepperoni pizza delivered to their hotel room. Why? Because that's not an option for us here. Right? It speaks to an authentic net. That is the real Muslim-American experience. Right? But I could sit here and critique Ms. Marvel. I could tell you Muslims in America are the only faith group that's not composed of a racial or ethnic majority. In America, we are about 38% black. We're about 27% South Asian origin, Pakistan, India, Bangladesh, Sri Lanka, etc. We're about 20-22% of Arab origin. And then the rest of us are like Willow Wilson, who wrote Ms. Marvel, just like random white people or whoever people that converted to Islam because they believe that this is a beautiful way to live your life. Right? So I can come here and I can tell you, no, this is not real. Ms. Marvel should be a black Muslim American. Because that would be most representing the Muslim American experience. But no Muslim American would ever say that. Why? Because of the intersectionality of identity. I'm not just a dude, and I'm not just Muslim, and I'm not just a professor, and I'm not just a I'm not just any one thing. I have many layers of many different things. And the only way that one can truly come to a place where you are exhibiting an authenticity that is distinct from other human beings is if you attempt to ascend the ladder of knowledge of self in connection with your perception of the injustices that exist in the reality around you. The second most significant experience that Ms. Marvel has in the comic books is she sees two people from her high school, boyfriend and girlfriend, and they had just been drinking, and they're on the pier, and girlfriend falls into the water. And boyfriend is so drunk that he can't get her out of the water. And Ms. Marvel busts this. She goes, I remember my father always talking about a verse in the Quran in which God says the killing of an innocent life is like the killing of all of humanity, and the saving of an innocent life is like the saving of all of humanity. And then she says, you know what? That means that it's incumbent upon me. I have a responsibility to save this person. And then she goes and saves this person, but she saves that person in the image of who? Carol Danvers. Carol, because it's early in the story. she hasn't yet become Kamala the superhero. She is still on a growth trajectory, right? And when she becomes Ms. Marvel in the Avengers series, and there's that what's it called, panel? That panel with like Captain America and all these people, there's like an endowing of her American experience as a Muslim. Right? When Ms. Marvel, Kamala Khan, the daughter of Pakistani Americans, takes the image of Carol Danvers, not as a static reality, but as an avenue for true self-authentication as an American Muslim, this is a revolutionary narrative. A revolutionary narrative. And I would be willing to say, as an expert on Muslims in America, this is the most powerful representation of who we are after the autobiography of Malcolm X. That's the weight. That's the weight that this work should receive. And so let me end with this. When they started this country, they wrote a series of articles in New York newspapers. And those articles came to be known as the Federalist Papers. And Alexander Hamilton, who at the time was an immigrant, wrote in the first paragraph of the first Federalist, "It seems to have been left to the people of this nation, by their conduct and example, to determine the question whether man is forever to be ruled, destined by fear and force, or whether we can build a constitution and a society that is based on reflection and choice. Comics and the ability of a Muslim American authenticity to emerge through this medium yields for us as Muslim Americans an opportunity to fully actualize the American story. The American mission, which is to live a life that yields not only to us but to all people around the world the ability to reflect and the freedom to choose a way of course that is different from the way of course of the oppressive." Thank you.
Taking questions immediately, but I wanted to like respond to Yusuf because I mean you guys really liked it when we did that last time.
seemed to be a lot of synergy in that. Yes, sir.
So one of the things that like killed me with your panel or with your talk was your representation of Captain Marvel as possibility, right? And so one of the things that I ejected from this presentation because theory. Is like the way in which Captain Marvel's choice to reject that power that would have let her save the world is a choice to reject the oppressive mentality that would have come with that power. So the experience of watching people with that power is the experience of watching people run around, you know, killing people, oppressing people, using violence to enforce one's own perspective upon multiple people so that one can have more power. That, in like 15 pages, is one of the things that I centered when talking about it, and that's what makes that scene so important. It's not simply that Carol makes a moral decision, it's that Carol makes the intentional moral choice to reject the possibility of becoming yet another oppressor in order to save people, right? She remains true to her position as a liberator. And the second thing is, in that scene that you brought up with Kamala Khan and the transferring of power, it's Carol who knights her. Right, it's the Avengers arrayed behind Carol who passes on that mantle, who accepts the possibility of someone other than her taking up that name and living the projected action of Miss Marvel. And that, I think, speaks almost completely to the power of imagination in Captain Marvel. Mm. So,
church for that?
I would actually like to respond to that before you respond to that by saying that I actually think that that's, you've touched on, like, this panel to some might have seemed as though we were talking about elements of feminism that show up in Kelly Sue's work in various ways, but there's actually this unifying theme here of this rejection of the power of the oppressor. Right,
which is a feminist theme.
It is It is a core feminist, component and ideology. So you've got this with Carol when she refuses to take on the power, when she refuses to become that bastion of oppressive structure powers. You've got it with Kamala in a much more subtle way when she refuses to not save someone, when she makes that intentional choice to actually be the kind of person she. wants to see in the world and wants to make that choice. Mm-hmm. And we see it in Pretty Deadly when we see Fox making, you know, that choice to become a better kind of man, to become a different kind of person than the, you know, restrictive, oppressive person that he had been. And then we see it again in Sissy when she makes her full choice. Mm-hmm. And so I think that that structure, that theme, flows through all of these elements of Kelly Sue's work. And I think it, we could say that it crystallizes, in a sense, in Bitch Planet, because we see this, you know, very outright, from the first page, rejection of the power of the oppressor. Like, immediate. Like, that is what the book itself entire is. And then talks about the ways in which that actually plays out when you're struggling hand-to-hand against that oppressor.
You also get a bit of the... what. Again, not to do this, but you also get her, you know, in Captain Marvel, rejecting the white saber complex, like the fact that you have to, as you know, the person with all this power, show up and save people. When Carol actually places herself at the command of Tick's people, right? And I think it's in the second issue of the New Run where Carol has in mind, I literally can't go out there and punch everybody to death, even though I want to.
I kind of want to.
And that's the way that I save people, but I need a new way. So I'm going to place my authority, my power, in the hands of these people who have none, and essentially that's what she does. Mm. She offers them the possibility for their own liberation while not doing it for them.
Right.
And, like, that theme itself...
Yeah.
shows up in Bitch Planet, and that's generally why this thing is so amazing.
Exactly.
Look, I mean, I think one of the things that...
You're doing okay. You're doing
is there
okay.
something wrong?
No.
We can talk to okay. each other.
Yeah, we can.
Josh is about to knock you out right now. let me just say a couple of things. I think it's a really important, like, I have yet to see a single word written by Kelly Sue DeConnick or a single image that was created pursuant to her writing that is an accident or is occasional, right? Like, the last trade of Captain Marvel is entitled Alice Volat Propis, right? Which means what? She flies with her own wings.
Yep.
And the significance in the connection between Kelly Sue's work and Willow's work is that Kelly Sue's attitude in her craft permits the space for the arrival, right, of a character that one would never believe has the opportunity or the power to fly with her own wings. A Muslim American woman. Now, I should tell you that Muslim American women have the second highest level of postgraduate education in compared to any group of women in the United States other than Jewish American women. Right? I should also tell you that 68% of Jewish Americans say that Muslim Americans face discrimination on a daily basis. So, understanding that these causes for justice are fundamentally linked to each other, and understanding Freire's idea of the connection between our understanding of the word, even if it's Kelly Sue's word, and the world within which we live, there's a dialectic tension between them. And each and every one of us is living that tension every day. Like this brother that was here in the front row yesterday, who was like, you know, you're bagging on white men, oh, his, whatever, and he walked out. Like, that brother can understand that whiteness is as complex as blackness. Right? And that there is a rich tapestry of culture in America. And that his identity can be a part of the narratives that we are all speaking to. And that he can be a part of the solution in our society, but he cannot displace our experience for his experience. Right? His subjectivity is not going to be allowed to be called objective reality. No, homie, that's your subjective reality, and our reality is distinct.
Precisely. Chandra, I would love to hear if you want to respond to any of the things that are happening right now.
This is the weirdest panel. I've been doing this for 20 years.
I know. Isn't it awesome? Isn't
it great? Awesome.
And then we're going to open things up to the floor. Yeah.
Okay.
Let's open it up to the floor. If anybody's got, you know, questions, comments they want to bring up.
Very easy question. I didn't catch your names.
Then let's make this happen. My name is Damian Williams. I'm your moderator. This is Jonathan Flowers. You see Carbondale. This is Ahmed Yunus. And this is Chandra Jenkins. They are. Sorry, I've lost your affiliations off the top of my head. Both from Chapman University, yes. So
your last, your name again?
Chandra Jenkins. With a C. It's also in the program.
Yep.
I just haven't managed to make any of the
other ones. Okay. It's fine. If by the way, if you would like to find names and affiliations of everybody and you did not yet get one, we've got some panel programs right up here, and everybody will be available to talk some more afterwards. That's who we are once again, and we're all very happy to be here with you.
So who has questions?
I have a question.
Right up here.
Kel just texted me. Hello, everyone. I'm super embarrassed, and I love you.
We love her, too.
Return the love.
Yeah.
Anyone else? Questions? Things that stand out to them in the process?
Did I say something?
Go for it, man. we're gonna keep throwing you prompts until something's like, until you have something you want to say to us, too.
I just want to say one thing about, like, I have been reading comics for 1 year. Chandra is the reason I'm reading comics.
Good job, Sean.
This is an amazing person. And, you know, I did this TEDx talk that is pinned to my Twitter page. And the TEDx talk is about how, for the last 15 years, I've been working on counterterrorism. I go on Fox News, I debate Bill O'Reilly about whether we're terrorists, or who are the terrorists, or what is jihad. That's what I do for the... And the TED talk is about... how can we sue? And that kind of work, although I don't use specifically Kelly Sue examples, how Kelly Sue and Willow and other representations like Sam Wilson, Captain America, how they gave me hope in a situation within which I wanted to walk away from this work. And so I just want to make one quick statement about the power of this medium. I'm working on my second doctorate. I have never experienced anything as amazing as the power of comics and graphic novels. I've never seen anything so honest. I've never seen so much nuance. I've never seen so much texture in how we talk about the realities that we live in the public square. And so part of me feels like a lot of what I've been hearing for the past few days is, how do we get the people that are writing the stuff to listen to us? How do we get them to react to us? I think that a lot of our energy can go towards going out to the rest of society and inducing them to come and have a conversation about the nuance and the texture and the beauty and the brilliance and the justice that exists in our realities or can exist in our future reality as an untested feasibility.
So, since we're apparently doing this as a dialogue.
All right, I think, are we all cool with that? We all cool with the dialogue? Fair enough, let's do this.
To bridge off of what Ahmed just said, right? So, again, I'm going to throw some theory at you. So John Dewey, like, he says the purpose of art is to make present a qualitative experience, right? This storm, this experience, this person, to, you know, everybody who stands before it. If we talk about comic books as a narrative and an art form, we're getting right into what Ahmed just said, right? So we are treating comics, right, as a way in which we can have that experience. We can experience the lived experience of other people through comics if it's done responsibly, right? If that aesthetic form is done responsibly. And what we get with Captain Marvel is a representation of the possibilities of the lived experience of a marginalized group, women, which bleeds into the possibilities of the lived experience of another marginalized group, Muslim Americans, which reaches out beyond the mere medium. And what Kelly Sue does with these works is put front and center these lived experience in a responsible, ethical kind of way. So when we ask people, or when people ask, how do we get people into this media? How do we get them to understand these things? We give them a comic book, right? We give them Captain Marvel. We give them Miss Marvel. And when they read it and they get like halfway through and it's like, oh, it's all about a woman. And they put it down. And we ask them why they put it down. They either have to respond from the perspective of those internalized structures of oppression, or they got to give us another reason. Usually they can't give us another reason, so we can ask why. Like, why are you doing this? Why did you come to this position? And we can ask them to come to a consciousness of their own internalization of various modes of oppression through our dialogues with comic books. Whether or not they like them, whether or not they're happy with the transformations of certain things, so on and so forth. We can do that through comic books, and that's the power of comic books. And not to like shift off of Kelly Sue, but March, right there. That's an example of what it does. But back to Kelly Sue. Yes.
I think she would endorse that.
I think she would,
we got a question.
She would 100% endorse the plug of March there. Yes.
Chandra. Hi. It's really interesting to think about like how different masculinities can be beneficial to narratives. Like they are pretty deadly. How do you think that compares to books like Captain Marvel, Mission Planet, where we have female-centric protagonists? Like, is it more or less equally differently helpful to have subversive masculinities and demonstrate different ways of acting out masculinity? Is that just as helpful as having female experience to be able to perform them? Does that make sense?
I'm gonna preface this by also saying I haven't read Captain Marvel yet because I don't have all the time in the world. I don't own a TARDIS yet, so if somebody has one and wants to loan me one, I'd love it. So it's on my list. But for Bitch Planet, I think it is very female centric, and I think it really only presents the toxic masculinity because that's the world it's created, which is interesting. Different, like how that's set up on like the descriptor on it. But I think the presentation of the different masculinities that could also be that show up in Pretty Deadly, because it's not just Fox. Like Fox is the best example, but I mean there's other characters as well in there that, and I think the second arc is going to have more of it if I had to guess based on some of the art that she's already shown from Emma. I feel like I know Emma too.
We all wish we did.
I think it's really helpful because it's a lacking element within feminist theory, a really good presentation of what something that isn't toxic in terms of masculinity. I think it is really helpful in a different way because it also helps to, I think it's equally as helpful of all of the strong and different presentations of femininity and what it means to be a female that show up in Bitch Planet, which everybody's in there, and then also within Pretty Deadly and in the, like what I know of Captain Marvel and Kamala Harris. I think it's equally as important. I think it's a both and thing. I don't think it's an either or. So I don't know if that answers your question.
I can totally respond to the Captain Marvel thing. You're up there, you go.
Okay, so the Captain Marvel thing, right? So there's a question about, you know, alternative representations of masculinity in Captain Marvel. So I'm going to go back to the first issue of the 2014 run of Captain Marvel, where Carol actually makes the decision to leave Earth, right? And I have it up on my iPad because I, you know, magic of technology, right? So Carol is talking to Rhodey, and he asks, his question is, this is what you want? And Carol says, yes. And he says, you're sure? And she says, yes. And then he says, then you gotta go. You gotta go. I will be many things for you, Carol Danvers, but I'm never going to be the one that holds you down. And then she asks, will you feed my cat? And he says, no, absolutely not. But cat feeding aside, that second panel, right? I will be many things for you, Carol Danvers, but I'm never going to be the one that holds you down, right? So this is, to bring in some of the intersectionality, this is a black man telling a white woman with whom he's in a relationship that he will not be the thing that keeps her from discovering who she is and what she can be. He will also not be the thing that feeds her cat.
Correct.
The not feeding of the cat is secondary to the representation of a black man who are often constructed as hyper-masculine, hyper-violent in comics, saying to a woman, I'm not going to hold you down. Go find what it is that you need. And if that's not an alternative representation of masculinity, I don't know what is. And it would be easy to dismiss that panel as a simple throwaway parting, but it's so very important. So very important. So.
So yes, Rhodey. Also Captain America in the very first, yes. When he says, take the mantle, when he is encouraging her, and not like you have to do it because I say to do it, I want you to look inside yourself and find this because you know it's there.
Yeah.
And
and Captain America as feminist support system.
Yeah.
Is a beautiful moment.
In Down, right, when Carol is faced with losing her ability to fly and Cap shows up and says, "Why didn't you tell me this?" And she says, "Because you'd look at me like that." And they have this incredible dialogue about how he recognizes that Carol has a moment of weakness, but it doesn't make her less of a person to him, right? And that he will be there to support her in whatever way that she needs, including bringing that awesome flying motorcycle. But that reconstruction of somebody like Captain America, who is like the icon, or is an iconic character, he represents something. And for him to say, look, I understand that you're having a moment of weakness. It doesn't make you less of me, less to me. Go figure this out, or figure this out. I will be here to help you in whatever way you need. Is incredibly powerful.
Can I ask you to respond to the same question?
Can I do it from a Ms. Marvel perspective? In Ms. Marvel, there are a number of male characters. The two most prominent are Kamala's father, who is a kind of typical first-generation immigrant, what we would refer to in the community as an uncle. And he is a very moderate, thoughtful, intelligent person who is kind of primed or postured towards helping his daughter achieve. The second character that is of significance in the series is Kamala's brother, who exhibits a level of outward religiosity that is challenged by their father, in which I remember a panel in which her father basically says to her brother, "I think your extreme form of religiosity is kind of like an excuse to not go out and get a job." And that's some real shit.
Yeah. You know,
like if we were having a panel here about terrorism, I assure you, job creation would be a part of that conversation, right? Like, I moved to the Middle East for 4 years. I built a $100 million social enterprise for a queen to create jobs for young people so that they wouldn't become terrorists. Like, the valence of these narratives matter, and they are real. And the last thing I'll say is, I see myself in Bitch Planet every single issue. I've been non-compliant for 36 years. 36 years I've been non-compliant, right? Part of that is because I was objectified and the dividing practices were placed upon me. And part of it is because I met people that helped me come to a knowledge of self, that helped me come to a realization. For me personally, that happened through hip-hop music. For other people, it happens through other things. But when I came to comics, I came to comics with the mindset of hip-hop. And when I came to comics with, because that is my mindset, not because it's a, that's who I am, that's how I live every single day. And when I read Bitch Planet, as it kept coming out, I kept seeing myself. I'm right there. That's right. That's exactly what happened to me with that dude, at that company, or at that country, or in that administration. And so I think it's really important for us to, like, we can find ourselves in any character. We can find ourselves in any character. And when we speak in that way, we expand the possibilities of what justice and beauty and mercy can look like in this society.
Yeah, I would have said that there's a third male character in Ms. Marvel. Her imam, I think, right?
The imam. That's true.
Her imam. She literally comes to him with a kind of crisis of faith over her superheroism, and he gives her the advice that propels her forward, right? Yeah. So I think it's the combination of that that religious faith and her father's moderation and the way that she sees her brother's kind of extreme form and her father's response to that creates Kamala as a complex Muslim character that allows her to go out into the world and be that hero, right? So three of those representations serve to support and build Kamala as a character rather than restrict and confine her, which is like incredible.
No, and he's the imam of her brother as well.
Right.
He's the imam of her father as well. Like, it's so brilliant, right? Like, it doesn't matter who your imam is. If you're an idiot, you're an idiot. You gotta move you forward. You know what I mean? Like we as Muslims have to re-own what it means to be Muslim. We have to enhance our literacy of Islam. And this point that the Professor Flowers just made, it's a brilliant point. Like, Kamala shows us how to balance, how one option of balancing
your Muslim identity and your American identity. When we grew up, we used to say the American Muslim identity is based on the proposition that there is neither dissonance nor friction between the founding principles of Islam and the founding principles of America. That means one can be 100% Muslim and 100% American at the same time. There is no representation that exists in our society, in our time, that speaks to that reality, like Kamala Khan.
Yeah.
I don't know why I just stood up.
I'm going to break in here. We're going to have to take our last question right here. Yeah, a little bit of pressure on that one.
I'm sorry. I know that this is a Kelly Sue-centric panel, but we're talking about Carl right now, and I would argue that there is yet another man in her life, and that is her best friend.
Bruno.
And who is as supportive, if not more supportive, than her family members and, by extension, her teacher. You know, so he's fulfilling that role from a different perspective, from a not subservient, because that is absolutely not the right word, but when I think of a support structure, her family is foundational, and he is what's helping her get higher.
Yeah, he's the structure of support that helps.
He's not asking for anything in return.
I would say, before the panel responds, I want to say, yes, this is a Kelly Sue-centric panel, but talking about Ms. Marvel in the context of Kelly Sue's works is actually, how else could you talk about Ms. Marvel? I mean, the work that G. Willow has done... The work that G. Willow has done has been 100% her own work. It has been an amazing piece of media. It's been an amazing narrative. It's been a fantastic story. It's been engrossing. It's been entertaining. It's been hilarious. And it's been groundbreaking. But the entire structure of the narrative of Kamala Khan is through her lens of becoming more like Carol Danvers, and Carol Danvers saying to her, become more like yourself, and building out of that. And the Carol Danvers that said that to her was Kelly Sue's Carol Danvers. So let's never forget that. We can talk about Kamala because we can talk about Kelly Sue, and we can talk about the dialogue and the relationship between them. So I want to hear from the panel, and then unfortunately, we're going to be a little bit over time, and I'm going to have to call it. I'm sorry.
So Bruno is really important, not only because of his support, but because, like, this dude is, you know, he's in love with Kamala, and he recognizes that Kamala doesn't really share those feelings, but he doesn't pull the fedora-wearing nice guy thing. Right? No, seriously. Like, he comes to an acceptance of the lack of reciprocation of their feelings, but still continues to support her, still continues to be there, still continues to even help her out when he sees her with other men. And that is something that, like, is really important to see, especially in teenage relationships, right? These are teenagers, yes. Right? That are engaging in this is a re-articulation of teenage masculinity, which is also often constructed as the most toxic form of masculinity, right? And so it is showing the possibility of a teenage masculinity that doesn't cater to that entitlement towards, you know, oh, I like this person, they have to like me back, et cetera, et cetera. It does that so very well because their friendship, while he's aware of his feelings for her, he does not allow her lack of reciprocity to change their friendship, right? He is still the same dude that is her best friend, even though she doesn't share those kinds of feelings. That is super important. Like, that is a lesson that needs to be taught, and if it can be taught through comic books, more power to it. But that I think is one of the most important aspects of Bruno's character.
You know, I think your question is absolutely brilliant, and it's so amazing that it comes from you, because you were to me in this conference what Bruno is to Kamala. You totally supported my experience here, and the conversations that we've had have been amazing. Look, I think Bruno represents Islam. Mm-hmm. And I haven't said this to Willow yet, so please don't tweet this.
Hold off on it.
I think Bruno represents Islam. You know, as the story moves on, Kamala then, another dude shows up who is a Desi. Desi means you're from the land, South Asia. And he shows up, and he's a bad dude. And everything that he does, Kamala kind of looks and she's like, yo, that's not really Islam, that's not what we're supposed to be doing. And there's a reverting back to Bruno. And so for me, as a Muslim American, it's the argument that Islam as an ethic
is not dominated or contained by Muslims. Right? Like, the beauty that God endows in humanity is not contained or limited to Muslims. And what Willow, I think, has offered us is not only a narrative of an ally, a male white ally, that is brilliant and is powerful and is strong and catapults her to this flying with her own wings, but it shows us how what we perceive to be the things that define us can be housed in the consciousness of the other.
Well, you're gonna have to change that after this one.
I tried to convince her.
No, it's not that I don't. I think it's great. I just don't have time. And
it's okay.
I think you'll really like Bruno as an octopus.
Probably. Yeah,
probably
like that's.
Really like it.
there is that. Fair enough. Everyone, I want to thank you once again for being here, and I want to thank all of our panelists for this absolutely fascinating discussion. Thank you so much. All of these presentations have been amazing. Your questions have been amazing. This entire weekend with all of you has been absolutely wonderful. So thank you so much for being here.